This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Clean Floors. Clean floors. They can exist. Not very often, but they can. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is called Island of the Blue Dolphins, Lost but Not Forgotten. There are few children's novels I've read more times than Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott Odell. The battered copy that I bought at the age of 8 finally fell apart a few years ago after decades of service. This book has remained one of the most popular and widely read children's books since it was first published in 1960. I found it captivating not just because it's a really well-written survival story, but also because I grew up in Southern California and am familiar with the places, plants, and people described in the book. This is the first of two episodes I will do about Island of the Blue Dolphins. Today, I'll talk about the historical context of the book, and next week, I'll talk about the novel itself. Whenever Island of the Blue Dolphins is taught, kids want to know how much of the story is real. There are a lot of scraps of information you can find online, and very little of it is accurate. We now know that the stories recorded in the 19th century ranged from mostly true to flat-out fabrications by people who never even met the lone woman of San Nicolas Island. I want this episode to be a brief, useful summary of the most accurate information discovered by historians, folklorists, and archaeologists, so that parents and teachers feel confident about answering kids' questions about what we do and don't know about the lone woman, or Karana, as she's called in the novel. I also want to point parents and teachers toward a very useful website created by Channel Islands National Park in Ventura, California. The site goes through Island of the Blue Dolphins chapter by chapter and not only summarizes the story, but provides a treasure trove of information from experts on the history, archaeology, and ecosystem of San Nicolas Island. Island of the Blue Dolphins is a work of speculative historical fiction. It is not and never could have been an accurate account of the life of the lone woman of San Nicolas Island. Scott Odell knew this when he wrote the book, and readers knew it when it was published. Odell carefully researched what could be known about his subject at the time, and then imagined one possible chain of events. His book was a gift to a woman who had been dead for over 100 years and was almost completely forgotten by the time Island of the Blue Dolphins was published. It completely reinvigorated interest in her and the extinct tribe that she came from. Today, San Nicolas Island, the Nicoleno people, and the lost woman herself are the focus of some of the highest quality archaeological and anthropological work in the world. And it's all because of Island of the Blue Dolphins. In an amazing way, fiction inspired the quest for fact. No one alive today knows the name of the woman who lived alone as the last inhabitant of an island off the California coast between the years 1835 and 1853. Nobody knows what her tribe called themselves or their island, and all that remains of their culture are a few words written down by those who looked after the lone woman and some artifacts archaeologists have unearthed. So what do we know? It's only in the last 10 years that meticulously fact-checked information has emerged from scholars like Stephen J. Schwartz, John Johnson, Susan Morris, and Carol Peterson. What you're about to hear is the most probable version of events, according to recent research, and it contradicts quite a lot of the outdated accounts you may have previously heard if you're familiar with this story. The lone woman was born on San Nicolas Island before the year 1811, and it's unlikely that she could have been born before 1800. The island was named by Spanish explorers, and its inhabitants later came to be called Nicoleños. This tribe, numbering somewhere between a few dozen to a few hundred people, was genetically and linguistically related to the Tongva people who lived in modern-day Los Angeles County. They were completely unrelated to the Chumash people who were from Ventura and Santa Barbara counties to the north. That'll be important later in the story. San Nicolas Island is very remote, 60 miles off the California coast. I have seen every one of the California Channel Islands from a mainland beach except San Nicolas. It's just too far away. The seas around the island are rough, which discouraged visitors, so the people there were very isolated. In the early 1800s, when ships owned by the Russian-American Company started coming to the island to hunt for sea otter pelts, the sailors found a hunter-gatherer society untouched by the modern world. In 1814, a Russian-American company ship captained by Yakov Babin and crewed by Aleut people from Sitka, Alaska, landed on San Nicolas. After striking a deal to hunt for otter, something went terribly wrong, and the Aleuts murdered many of the islanders. A subsequent investigation by the RAC found that Captain Babin claimed the incident was caused by the murder of an Aleut by a Nicoleño. The massacre was also described as an extermination. 21 years later, the Nicoleño people had not recovered, as even more of them had died due to exposure to diseases from visiting sailors from which they had no immunity. Estimates of the size of the tribe range from a high of 30 to a low of just 7. The Nicoleño made a decision to go to the mainland. There were plenty of jobs in Los Angeles, a higher standard of living, and no chance of being attacked by marauding sailors. The Nicoleño didn't have to factor in the cost of sacrificing their language and culture. Sadly, there was no chance of their society surviving at this point, so saving individual lives had to come first. In November 1835, a schooner called the Peores Nada, better than nothing, came to San Nicolas, and all but two of the Nicoleños got on board. One woman, who was probably in her 20s, refused to board the ship. Her son, probably aged between 5 and 10, was nowhere to be found. We don't know why this is, but we can speculate that perhaps the boy was afraid to sail away from his home, wandered off to play, or was just being stubborn. The sea grew increasingly rough, so the Peores Nada had to set sail. The woman lived on the island for nearly a decade with her son until he was killed by some kind of sea creature, possibly a great white shark or orca, while fishing in his canoe. So the lone woman of San Nicolas was really only alone for half of her 18 years after the Nicoleño evacuation. And oddly, she had visitors from time to time. Crews of Chinese abalone harvesters might have operated on San Nicolas while the lone woman was there, and smugglers sometimes used the island as a place to trade goods without having to pay taxes at port. One smuggler was left on San Nicolas for 60 days to guard cargo during the time the lone woman was there. For her sake, I hope she managed to stay hidden from him. At any rate, people certainly knew that a woman was there, because in a newspaper as far away as Boston, the following depressing article entitled "A Female Caruso" appeared. A portion of it reads, "Since our Caruso has become the sole monarch of the isle, San Nicolas has been visited perhaps 10 or 12 different times by different individuals. Those who have seen her at this latest period report that she appears to have lost all knowledge of language, and when taken and detained against her will, becomes frightened and restless, that the moment she is liberated, she darts off and attempts to secret herself in the wild grass, or amongst the rocks which hang over the never-ceasing surf." Gee, I wonder why a woman who's completely on her own would be freaked out when a bunch of filthy men show up at her home and hold her captive, especially after childhood memories of similar men murdering quite a lot of her people. I also have to shake my head at that boneheaded comment about how she lost knowledge of language. She wouldn't have known any of the languages spoken by the multi-ethnic crews invading her space. And it's hard to expect the woman to have prioritized being friendly and articulate when she was probably terrified for her life. A Santa Barbara-based captain named George Nidever made two journeys to San Nicolas in 1852, during which he found footprints proving the woman was alive. And in 1853, the lone woman allowed herself to be discovered by Nidever's crew. There's no way to know why. Perhaps she'd had the opportunity to observe Nidever and felt she could trust him. Maybe she was just tired of being alone and decided to take a chance. She was found in an outdoor windbreak made of whalebone, wearing a dress of green cormorant feathers, and accompanied by two loyal guard dogs. Her rescuers noted that she was clearly resourceful and intelligent. She had preserved food and utilized every part of plants and animals efficiently. She was described as being very cheerful, constantly talking, laughing, and singing, without being discouraged by the fact that nobody could understand her. Her rescuers stayed with her on the island for about a month, hunting otter, before bringing her to Santa Barbara. On the journey back, a storm blew up, and she prayed to make it go away, which gives the only insight we have into her religious beliefs. Captain Nidever took her home so that his family could care for her. His wife was Mexican, and the primary language in the home was Spanish. The Nidever children were very excited to have her in the home and played with her frequently. The people who rescued her genuinely cared about her well-being and tried to do whatever they could to make her happy and ideally find some of her people. The lost woman was happy with her hosts. She very much enjoyed coffee and alcohol, substances she never could have imagined before, and was amazed by the sight of horses and oxen, as the largest land animal she'd ever seen before was a small dog. The lone woman was delighted by visitors and enjoyed entertaining them with singing and dancing. Accounts of her leave a picture of a friendly woman who enjoyed life's simple pleasures and valued the companionship of others. It's also remarkable that despite her ordeal, she retained a cheerful personality and doesn't seem to have become bitter or withdrawn. Numerous efforts were made to communicate with her, and some progress was made with sign language. But the Chumash-speaking people in Santa Barbara couldn't understand her words. If the lone woman had lived longer, it's possible that one of the Tongva people from Los Angeles could have been brought to meet her and might have had better luck, as their languages came from the same group as that of the Nicoleño. The lone woman became gravely ill with dysentery several weeks after arriving in Santa Barbara. Those who knew her attributed it to her sudden change from a lifelong diet of plants and seafood to a rich modern diet of unfamiliar ingredients. That may have been part of it, but it's more likely that as a member of a genetically isolated island society, she was extremely vulnerable to microbes that were less deadly to people whose ancestors had already been exposed to them. She was conditionally baptized with the name Juana Maria by a Catholic priest who didn't give her full baptism as she had no idea what Christianity was. She was buried in the grounds of Mission Santa Barbara, and though the location of her grave is unknown, she's remembered with a plaque. Almost nothing tangible remains of the lost woman of San Nicolas. The basket, clothing, and tools she brought with her from the island were given to the California Academy of Sciences, but these items were destroyed in the citywide fire that happened after the massive earthquake of 1906. Her skirt of cormorant feathers was apparently given to the Vatican, but its location is unknown today. The lyrics to one of her songs were written down, but the meaning is unknown. In 1939, the location of the lost woman's hut was found, with remnants of the whalebone fence still intact. In 2012, archaeologists working on San Nicolas found two redwood boxes stuffed with jewelry, dishes, harpoon tips, and many other items that were possibly packed away by the lost woman because, given the date of the finds, there would have been nobody else on the island to handle them. and that's all that remains of the lone woman and her people. The few survivors delivered to San Pedro Harbor by the Peores Nada scattered across Los Angeles, and most of them died or disappeared from history very quickly. Very little is known about these people, and there's no evidence that any of them had children. The last known surviving Nicoleño was a man who was baptized in Los Angeles with the name Tomás. His marriage to Refugio López was recorded in 1860, and nobody knows what happened to him after that. Maybe his descendants still live in L.A. today and don't know who they are. Do me a favor. If your great-great-great-grandpa was called Tomás and lived on 6th Street, go get a DNA test and let me know what you find out. I have based this summary on information that's been given within the last few years by dedicated researchers, scientists, and scholars. At childrensliteraturepodcast.com, I've listed the names of people who I feel are the most reliable sources that you should turn to when teaching about Island of the Blue Dolphins and the real story behind it. The only information you should trust on YouTube about the history of the Lone Woman can be found on the channel run by Channel Islands National Park. Every other source I've found has massive errors and does not reflect current historical understanding. Channel Islands National Park hosts an excellent lecture series every year, and there are many fascinating videos about the Lone Woman and San Nicolas Island that aren't too long and can easily be understood by both teachers and students. Additionally, Channel Islands National Park developed an extensive website that has the chapter-by-chapter analysis of Island of the Blue Dolphins that I spoke about before. All of these links are on the show notes for this episode. I've created an activity you can do with your kids that will help them understand how information changes over time and how to choose good sources. For example, an ancient medical textbook is a fascinating piece of history, but you certainly wouldn't use it for advice on how to treat diseases today. When we get newer and more accurate information, it doesn't make older sources bad or wrong, just outdated. We can reference old information to give historical context, but students should rely on the most current sources in order to put forward the best, most likely version of a story. 18 years is a very long time to live alone, or nearly alone, even in a place that's home. The true story of the last inhabitant of San Nicolas Island is sad in many ways. It also shows how messy the multicultural world created by global exploration and colonization was. The Nicoleño probably wouldn't have been able to survive the waves of unfamiliar diseases that decimated all Native American tribes. Other tribes on the California Channel Islands were bigger and had stronger economies and better connections to the mainland, and they didn't make it. But the Nicoleño were definitely doomed when most of them were slaughtered by other indigenous people who were sent by a Russian corporation to collect goods to sell in China. It's a strange and sad story about how one tiny little place was the eye of a global hurricane. The lone woman would have possibly seen Chinese, Hawaiian, Mexican, and European travelers on or near her island. She would end up finally trusting a mixed crew of white and Chumash sailors. She would be cared for in Santa Barbara by a white man and his Mexican wife. She would be tended to in her last hours by Spanish Catholic priests, whose language and faith meant little to her. However, we do know that what meant a lot to her was the kindness of the individuals who made her last weeks so pleasant, whatever their race or background. Although we may never discover all of the story of the lone woman of San Nicolas Island, I'm glad that her story hasn't been lost, and grateful for Island of the Blue Dolphins to make sure she's never forgotten. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a rating. Send comments to letters at childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.